Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to the AEW Double or Nothing 2023 review live from Las Vegas. I am Michael Sidgwick, joined by fellow Dudley Boy Michael Hamflett to discuss everything that's just gone down on tonight's show. But before we get into it very quickly, if you are a fan of this sort of thing, make sure to subscribe to What Culture Wrestling on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts from. For daily wrestling podcasts, we preview and review Raw, SmackDown, the show formerly known as NXT 2.0, Dynamite, Rampage, premium live events, pay-per-views, we have wrestler discussion, wrestling interviews, roundtable discussions, and we host, not this week, a roundup of the week complete with a bloody good quiz, of course, on wrestle culture. Hamflett, the first live AEW pay-per-view experience for me, half of it lived up to my wildest expectations. Mm-hmm. The other half did not. I can understand why the average Joe watching it on TV might have been somewhat underwhelmed, mm-hmm. and we can bear that in mind when we review it, but we had a great time.
We did, and I like that you've already, in the introduction alone, given that sort of broad spectrum of thoughts from us trying to imagine what it would have been like to watch it at home, to accept that our live viewing, not only because it was live, but because it was our first AEW pay-per-view, because we've flown halfway across the world to see it, it's going to carry a certain different stock than people that are just simply watching at home. But then I expect nothing less from one of the hosts of the only wrestling podcast worth of, not our words, the words of AEW World Heavyweight Champion Maxwell Jacob Friedman. So, like, I'm not surprised.
Yes.
It's just what I would come to expect, and I imagine our listeners feel the same. We talked about this in the, I was going to say in the breaks, in these split seconds between a wrestler leaving and another wrestler arriving, we talked about how we would address this. So we might as well do it off the top and we can crack on with the show. I never wanted to be a podcast. I love going to watch wrestling live, but I never wanted to be a podcast that denied the television experience just because it was live in the building.
Yeah.
We've talked with our listeners through Twitter, through emails, whatever, and they've often contacted us and said, what are you dogging the crowd for? They were class. And it's like, there can be two answers here. There absolutely can be two answers. I know what I heard with my ears, but I equally, other than occasional sound issues and miking issues with AEW, I don't doubt the television audience as well, because the theme, one of the themes of AEW this week in Vegas, truthfully, has been, it's not hot.
Yeah.
And I think that was on a card, and I agree with you, there were peaks on this card, well, we sat next to each other, that were sky high, and we witnessed each other experiencing them. You can't quite get away from that, even though this Dynamite, in terms of atmosphere and experience, dwarfed the one that we had at Dynamite and Rampage earlier in the week.
Yeah, absolutely. There were moments, nay, almost full-length matches, where there were no crowd dips, or they were very, very low and just customary with the story being told and the downtime and the selling. There were three matches here that were absolutely white-hot.
Yep.
There was one match that got a nice, respectful reaction, then pretty much got hotter than anything else on the night. And the rest were peaks and troughs.
Yeah.
Here's a big stunt. Pop for that. Yeah. It's just not a product that is completely and utterly white-hot. And it's just the kind of weird, bleak reality that AEW endures in 2023.
When the characters and stories are connecting in the way that we've seen them connect in the past, not just in AEW, in pro wrestling, when characters and stories are connecting, the bits in between the setup and execution of a cool move generate just as much, if not more, excitement because it's the anticipation.
Yeah.
It's the trying to get into the wrestler's head because you love them or hate them or whatever. And those gaps were notable in those matches that you're referencing. Especially jarring because the work is almost always so good.
Yeah.
And I think that's why it's more noticeable. I don't want to neg, say, your standard WWE Raw match, but they're even like told to wrestle to that lowered standard.
Yeah.
It's almost like they're working to those quiet WWE crowds. These wrestlers on this card don't do that.
Yeah.
So it's almost like the highest of highs, the euphoric moment of the, oh my God, he's going up to that turnbuckle, he's doing that move, followed by the execution of it. And then, right, it's good. Wait for my next one now. That reveals a fundamental lack of interest in that person and the story they're trying to tell rather than the actions they portray.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah. There was no emotion. I think the most emblematic example, and we'll get to it like imminently when we go match by match, is Wardlow Christian.
Yeah.
The connective tissue, the fans just weren't into it at all. And the genuinely incredible stunts that I did not expect. I thought it would go way more understated, like old school, to use a, you know, a bastardized term. But they got the bump there, the pops for those stunts, because of course they were going to. But yeah, there was no emotion when they were trying to tell that story realistically. But we'll start very, very quickly at the buy-in. It was Hardy Party versus the Guns and Ethan Page. Look, I'm in a good mood.
Mm-hmm.
Elements of the match were fun, I guess. Ethan Page was doing a Jeff Hardy dance when they were getting the heat, and did it for so much longer than I expected him to do it, to the point where I almost got uncomfortable. So that was good. The Guns bumping all over the shop with these flailing tumbles out of the ring. Great commitment, great bit. The match really fell apart at one point when Jeff Hardy went to perform Whisper in the Wind and just completely fell off the ropes. He looked like he'd injured himself quite badly. He was like practically lying down by the turnbuckles and
nursing
the ropes.
A leg, wasn't
he? Yeah, yeah. Like lying down at one point. He got up for the finish. The Hardys were incredibly over. I think botch aside, this wasn't a particularly good match or a memorable match. And even as get the crowd unglued, kickoff fair, it went on some time.
Yeah, but three three hot tags. I couldn't believe it. And it was in that way, it's that entitled wrestling fan way. These people are falling on their backs to my entertainment. And
you really get a sense of that live as well.
Yeah.
More so than on TV.
Totally. And I was cross in that way that I was like, this should have finished ages ago. That tag should have been the last tag. It was impossible to work out in the building without help from the announcers what on earth was happening, and the camera work for that matter, what on earth was happening with Jeff Hardy, because he was selling in that way that like a wrestler gets injured for real. So then you look at the referees and you're trying to discern from that, and we couldn't. There was confusion around us. You could sense it from people in the building because that Whisper in the Wind, I think it was like
he got injured before.
One spot earlier was where people saw him pull up, because then there was a sense of don't do that, Jeff, and he did do it, and then he just like his body zigzagged down that rope. It was a horrifying fall. And, you know, it's Jeff Hardy, he suffered worse, but there was no sense of control to it from what I can recall. And I just thought it was, I don't know, I didn't want to see Hook, like, sell and reach out for the tag in that traditional way that he was asked to do. His hot tag should have been the first and only time he was in the match, doing the impact stuff. Because they give him the win, which you point out that, like, Hook got the victory.
Yeah.
And, like, this was supposed to be Matt Hardy's big claiming of Ethan Page's contract, and yet the finish existed to elevate a Hook.
Yeah.
But couldn't you have done that with the, like, could Hook not have got in the ring, exploded on people, and then won? And it was like, this puts him over above the Hardys.
He could, but at some point, he has to do a traditional match.
Yeah.
Maybe we're being impatient, and this is just a way to just gradually develop Hook in and around a feud that sucks.
It wouldn't be a wrestling podcast if we didn't say this. Jeff Hardy got an absolutely thunderous moneymaker world champion reaction.
So over.
You cannot deny it ever.
Like, Matt Hardy's so over as well. They chant delete for everything he does. Like, this is one of the most over matches outside of the four.
Yeah.
Which we'll get to the four.
They've got Ethan Page's contract, so get used to some more of that.
No, I don't want to. The first of the four was the opener, which was unbelievable. Yeah. I tweeted after the fact, did that come off as the best battle royal anyone's ever seen live? Not including Rumbles.
Hmm.
But my God, they had a finishing sequence that rivals the very best Rumbles.
So hot.
Like Gunther, Cody, Shawn Taker, Cassidy, Swerve.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, there was an... we'll get to the rest of the match. I can't recap it. I'm not Adam Wilborn. We'll get to the rest of the match and the highlights of it more specifically, like, in a moment. But that... It was so white-hot, that final showdown between Swerve and Caster. You genuinely thought the titles might get switched here. Yeah. And what I loved about it was that Caster started to do the zigzag and that Swerve does first.
Mm.
As if to say, oh, you know, I can do this. Yeah. I study. I might seem like I don't, but I do. And then... the apron stuff, there was just so much tension and suspense, and like some of the convoluted counters, like they played a game of chess. Unbelievable. Big Bill is the best wrestler in the world.
Oh my god,
Big Bill is the sort of wrestler who is just so banter. Everything he does looks so great. He was booked superbly in here because he was just chucking loads of people out.
Yeah.
And then the field was thinning and you're thinking, Big Bill is not only going to win this, I really want him to win this.
Yeah.
So he was doing these, like, rampaging across the ring. He's so quick, particularly for a big fella, but he's just quick by wrestling standards.
Gobbled up the hatred. He was clearly booked to win of sentimental favourites, and he knew it, and he's been a star before.
Yeah.
So he was like, well, I'm not just going to eliminate them and crack on. He sold every one of them, like, I hope I've personally offended every single buddy in this crowd.
You know what this was?
What's that?
This was... the 2015 Royal Rumble Kane and Big Show run, except excellent.
Yeah. The targeted assault on the face.
The big lad killing people, your favourite people, yeah. And he was just happy as a pig inch as a result. Brian Cage was doing some impossible stuff.
Commander and Phoenix's high spots were used really, like, elegantly.
Yeah.
It wasn't... what are you doing climbing the top rope in a battle royal? This.
Yeah.
Like, and then they came undone in the end as well. Like,
Commander's rope walk, again, it's the sort of thing you see on telly and you can see him telegraph it and you've seen it on GIF, so when you see it on telly, it's like, okay, I've seen that. He, like, got halfway between the top rope and the rafters, it felt like, with that dive. It was absolutely incredible. So Big Bill, I want to talk about Big Bill. Big Bill does these incredible big boots and he's just gobbling up the heat and he's just genuinely on a rampage. He does this, there's a few more twists in it, but basically his boss man slam.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Jesus Christ. He was like playing with a child in there.
Yeah.
And like, you know, when you fake wrestle your kids
and
you do the thing where you just... put them really high in the air and then gently lower them down.
Yeah.
He put them really high in the air and then slammed them down. It felt like they were like he was making them sick with how dizzy with the rotations.
I was going to say like a four rotation black hole slam at one point, wasn't it? Where he just kept going and kept going.
It was absolutely incredible. Big Bill absolutely rules. There's probably loads that I'm missing from here. So is there, what other highlights did you have from it?
I loved the something I wanted to flag. But I love the camaraderie of the Lucha Brothers, Bandido, Commander, extending out to best friends because of the interpersonal relationships. We previewed in detail how this Battle Royal was full of mini feuds.
Yeah.
I hadn't given them credit for mini friendships.
Yeah.
And like Orange Cassidy in the press scrum afterwards, kind of half in character, half not. And I say half in character and half not because we realised during the match, and the commentary might have put this over, we were watching live, that Orange Cassidy was kind of inadvertently responsible for both of his best friends getting eliminated. Yeah. And they've touched upon that once before in the Orange Cassidy International title run. And this felt too pointed for them to not revisit that. Like, he's survived seemingly the impossible odds. And his friends have gone by the wayside yet again to make it so. I'm not suggesting a split, but I wonder what drama there is to take from that because it seems like it wasn't just there by accident.
Yeah, Trent and his retweets have got a... energy. Chuck Taylor, as we know from loads of viral clips in his history in the his early history in the indies, can be a great heel. Could it be time for the best friends to turn heel?
I think it would be ideal.
Yeah,
it's probably been time for a couple of years, isn't it?
Yeah.
But like, I think they'd probably be a benefit to the tag division, whereas at the moment they're kind of just warm bodies in it.
Yeah.
One other note, this felt like the beginning of the end for one of our little favourite bits of otherwise pointless lore, which is the success of the Butcher and the Blade in Battle Royals. They were kind of just disposed of it.
Yeah.
So maybe that's the end of something that was just fun for a while that we got to have that. So.
Indeed. The second match, for me, a monumental disappointment. There is absolutely no getting around it. And we're not the... it's cool to hate Jericho. He's always out of fashion. guys, we've really put over this program, so much so that I was really disappointed by this. And it was an unsanctioned match that peaked in the first minute when someone who wasn't involved, Sabu, jumped off the top turnbuckle and put someone I couldn't see, to be honest, through the table.
I think it was Cole Hanange, maybe.
Yeah, one or 2.0. And then it was basically inserted the guest enforcer for A, a cheap pop, B, to just fill that plot hole right up of the JAS could just interfere at any point. But they've been warded off by Sabu. And then with an insane, like, ridiculous spot that I just loved and popped for, got a huge reaction in the building. And that was the spike, that was the highest spike of that atmosphere, if you look at it like a waveform, because if you look at it like a waveform, like I'm recording on the Audacity program right now, when you are quiet, there's a little blue line. And then when your voice picks up, it goes up and down like that.
Yeah.
It's just a thin blue line of noise this match for most of it. Then you get a spot and it goes up. It just felt like there was so much conspiring against this. Certain things just did not click. There was a line salt spot where they got in each other's way. Then Adam Cole very obviously got into position to take it again. And then he popped up and tried to superkick Jericho. I don't know how it came off on TV. It didn't look particularly good in the arena.
It was the all-time great Adam Cole ricochet superkick spot.
Yes.
And that's ricochet, for Christ's sake. Like, that's an incredibly ambitious thing.
The Jericho's nothing if not ambitious.
True, but when they went back to it, I thought that was not like them.
Yeah.
Because you could kind of see what was going to happen the first time. And then when it didn't work out, it was like, oh, we'll just have to leave that one. And then it went straight back to
it.
Chains around legs and arms never work because the chain just slips and it looks fake. Like, you're wasting your time. Hit him with it.
Yeah. There was a chain. They had a sort of a mini match within a match, like a mini dog collar match within a match at one point, and the chain was wrapped around Cole's ankle somehow. That didn't help. There was a protracted Walls of Jericho Lion Tamer spot where it seemed to take an eternity for Cole to actually retrieve the fire extinguisher, and then when Jericho did the slapstick, turn around, watch that. I know what it is, spray it with me in the face, because that's the spot. It didn't feel like he could have just let go and ran away.
Yeah.
Jericho, his body language was fun.
Mm-hmm.
He was, during the heat spot, he did actually generate a little bit of heat because his body languages and his facial expressions were good. And there were a few good spots in there. Like, there was a nice sort of what happened. Oh, it was a Judas effect, miss, duck, but then he got the chain around Cole's throat. There's probably some other things I'm missing. And then the finish is that Adam Cole, with vengeance, bloody vengeance on his mind, shoot gave Jericho a black eye. Like, fair dues for doing that for the finish, because I think you've gone for that, the Mick Foley thing of punch me and mark me up and I'll look like I'm really, really damaged. So they've gone in a hard way finish. But the crowd jeered it relentlessly.
Oh, died in the building.
It got boos. It was rejected. It was like, it wasn't a good finish. I thought it was a decent idea for a finish.
Mm.
And maybe we've overrated the storyline, because if it was this good and Adam Cole was just pounding on Jericho's face so hard in retribution that he's marked him up for reals, and the crowd just booed the hell out of it. Is that because they just weren't into the match? They were expecting a lot more from it. They don't really take... Like, if Moxley is a babyface is doing that, and he's smashing the crap out of a heel's face, and they call it off with a chain wrapped around his fist, that's probably a badass finish. Maybe that's not the wrestler people want Cole to be or take him seriously as.
You said on the Dynamite review, and you used Moxley as the exact example, that Cole... like, has to be very careful delivering the lines he was delivering in the contract section. This was a good feud rather than a blood feud.
Yeah.
I was out for some middle of the night
rhyming.
It was just like a really fun bit of business on television. And the only time it was a blood feud is the only other thing I can think of as a takeaway from this match, which was, and it, like, again, this is like the crowd got hot for this, but it may as well have been like a moonsault that they got hot for. Jericho wanted to like take Cole's head off with a kendo stick. And Britt Baker came to get her revenge for the attack. And then Saraya tried to cut off Britt Baker's interference. and that got us to a Dynamite match.
The Britt Baker stuff got really over.
Got really over in the building. But again,
she smacked him as well.
Well, yeah, she took her revenge, and that felt real, and that felt quite
more real than Cole's.
Well, that felt like the blood feud element.
Yeah.
And that was the week where it became a blood feud. And in reality, was there anything they did? Like, you think back now, we were raving, and rightfully so, I believe, raving over the Roderick Strong match and the idea that Adam Cole can't get in the building. Can't get in the building, really, is actually like, in this context, was quite entertaining, rather than the two men signing a contract that they promised they wouldn't touch each other for the pay-per-view. This wasn't Triple H Austin, Three Stages of Hell. You know what I mean? Like, I think they were better when they were funnier, they were better when they were more entertaining in the build.
Yeah, the tone was a bit off.
It was a bit all over the shop, and the only point at which the tone was blood feud was the Britt Baker beatdown, and that's why that was so well received in the building.
Yeah.
And to be fair, kind of interested in the mixed tag. There was the most incredible feeling of dread, but like knowing welcome dread when Saraya and Jericho were on screen together as partners. I hated it, and I didn't hate it, if you know what I mean. I was like, oh, not you two.
Yeah.
But I kind of want to see it. I want to be like, no, not you two.
Two
like,
horrible people.
Don't take the piss. Yeah. Don't take the piss. Don't get boyfriends involved in rap band feuds. Like, don't pat yourself on the back too much. But I want to look at it at least once.
Yeah. Two incredibly detestable characters.
Yeah.
And putting them together could really be something. Mm-hmm. But not too much. I'm with you. The third match, Michael Hamflett experienced Nirvana.
Jesus Christ.
It was Jeff Jarrett and Jay Lethal versus FTR. And this was a masterpiece for what it was. This was so unbelievably fantastic. I was in heaven watching this. It wasn't just the vicarious joy in living through Hamflett, because I had joy of my own. A exorbitant amount of it. So what happens is, I called this, I'm not being funny, right? I said in the preview that if you looked at the talent involved and the minds involved and the story, this could be like loads of different good matches, different types of matches, perfected and just fused together. This was exactly that, because some of the actual wrestling, we winced at those Dax chops on Jay Lethal. Oh. We absolutely smiled and marvelled and got shocked and wrong-footed at the proper Southern-style slapstick.
Yeah.
The cardio for which was really impressive, like the do-si-do spots and...
Oh, yeah, all the rock and roll midnight stuff.
Yeah, it was absolutely tremendous.
Yeah.
And then he got some like great liquid wrestling, like modern technical, I guess you would describe genre-wise, between Lethal and Dax and Cash at various points. And I vividly remember saying to Hamflett, when admittedly the crowd was respectful, but not white hot, this is class and we haven't even got to the bollocks yet.
Yeah.
And then the bollocks happened, and the facial expressions, and Karen Jarrett getting more heat than basically anyone in the company. And like, this is your match. This is your match, to quote Tully Blanchard. So I won't talk too much. Hand over to you. But there was a point, well, no, there was like a million points in the last 5 to 7 minutes when I was just going, just making stupid noises.
Yeah.
But why was I making those noises? And you can go through it.
Because when Jeff Jarrett signed for AEW, the dread amongst the audience was about as far away from the timeline we already live in today, which some of us could have told you was going to happen, guys, which is fan service. Yeah. Jeff Jarrett is a fan service wrestler. Now people have understood the value of a Jeff Jarrett. And he has enhanced that, to be fair. Like, he's over-delivered in this spot. But he has become a fan service wrestler in that he and Jay Lethal and this act and this, you know, like this tag team that believe in themselves and believe in their wily, dirty, cheating ways as much as anything. But Jeff Jarrett especially believes that he is very entitled to the belt that he is yet to win. So at this point, the fact that he continues to fail and all the ways that are starting to connect in the way that he fails become an act of fan service. It becomes, we're going to see this bit, we're going to see this bit, we're going to see this bit. And yet what they're doing is they're adding like an extra treat each time, so you're getting a little bit more from each time. So it was in the second one where Jarrett first added there, pre-pinfall.
He did it for a minute.
That when he said Nirvana, Like, I think that was it. I'm not sure I remember the finish. I blacked out in that moment because it was so good.
You previewed and Nate hoped for him to do that again.
Yeah.
And he did it for like, what felt like 40 beautiful seconds.
It was like wish fulfillment of you getting the entirety of Brian and Kenny on your birthday.
Yeah.
For me, that spot was. But then, yeah, the advancement of the Mark Briscoe friendship storyline has been so delicately done, because it was only when, like, Jeff Jarrett was like, "You are of absolutely no use to me. I've never respected you, you hillbilly freak."
Yeah.
That all of a sudden, he just, the guard, the mask completely slipped. And the sequence that led up to it, not in my wildest dreams did I imagine I would get two guitar spots. And I don't know what goes beyond wildest dreams that gets me to the second one. Because Karen Jarrett, as we kind of did suggest, was the perfect last-minute addition to this menagerie of bastards. What an act, by the way. Like, watching them live, genuinely, like, FTR were the special guests in the Planet Jarrett show. This gorgeously pantomime for 2023 pro wrestling acts. When you look at diversity of matches on cards, Christ almighty, a Triple H pay-per-view could do with Planet Jarrett. Because they wouldn't give you a match that goes 5 minutes too long and is a technical masterclass between two great in-ring workers. It'd have a bit of flavour and it'd have a bit of character. Jeff Jarrett's more valuable to a WWE card than is an AEW one. There's diversity across it, at least in AEW. All the shtick, Sonjay Dutt, right, I want to isolate for praise, because he was constantly joined, like, he never stopped moving.
Yeah.
So he constantly joined with the fans. Satnam Singh, you said this straight away, with a laugh, with a chuckle. He's as tall as the top rope.
Yeah.
He's the biggest guy. It's a remarkable piece of business Satnam Singh is even in wrestling.
Yeah.
And with these guys, it's just the best. And then Karen Jarrett, who was getting heat all night, because we'd said this, and I was excited to watch it happen, like, I don't think AEW fans are ready for Karen Jarrett.
Yeah, nah.
They were walking down to the ring and stopping halfway down to just, like, give the old backhand threat to a couple of people at ringside. I was like, this is going to go really well.
Yeah.
It's going to go really, really well. And the sequencing that's set up, of course, Mark Briscoe gets bumped. And Aubrey Edwards, and this is LTST within itself, Aubrey Edwards is the one to be running down to count FTR to win the match. And Mark Briscoe, which I believe we also called, has done a double, yeah, because he's getting rid of them one by one by one. Sonjay Dutt won't let Aubrey Edwards get to the ring.
His face is amazing.
He is, like, standing, doing the Doink Mirror spot where she moves and he moves and she moves and he moves. And then Sonjay Dutt slides out the way. Karen Jarrett kabongs her with a guitar. Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Like, Karen Jarrett inadvertently fell over. So did I. Because at that point, I was just in ecstasy at watching this thing play out. Jarrett gets his near fall, but FTR get the win. I'd never been happier to see FTR be, like, kind of spare parts in their own feud. This was wonderful.
They did loads of the, like, proper nuts and bolts stuff. We should put over Cash Wheeler, because we noticed as well when Jarrett was kicking the back of his legs. You kind of have to bump big for Jarrett.
Yes.
And he was just legs in the air, nearly on the back of his neck.
Cash Wheeler snap, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, God. All of this was utterly fantastic. It just kept one twist, the next. It was just, I was delirious with fun watching this.
We were in our section, I think it's safe to say, the most excited, earnestly, for Jeff Jarrett to win a belt.
Yeah.
But make no mistake, the heat in the building was real for FTR to win.
Yeah.
They found panic in Jeff Jarrett winning. So as much as I say, through my lens, they know what they've got now with the Jeff Jarrett form, and fans like to enjoy watching it. They like to enjoy watching it, but there is still fear that man is going to hold the belt. You should probably keep playing with that.
Yeah.
Because
he should probably win one.
Like, does he smash Wardlow's legs with a guitar?
Yeah.
Like, do you know what I mean? Like, is there a way to finagle him back into something? Because people would love hating it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. The match was just so much
fun. I cannot wait to watch this back. I cannot wait.
It was so goddamn much fun. We mentioned it earlier. Christian Cage lost to Wardlow, didn't win the TNT title in a ladder match next, I believe.
Yeah.
And this is the match we were talking about, where some of the stunts were absolutely unhinged. Wardlow senton off the Jeff Hardy size ladder was unbelievably well done.
Gorgeous.
And we were terrified in that building. Christian Cage, that was on Luchasaurus, who had interfered, which actually I want to make a point of too much. Almost every single match, in fact, 7 out of 9 had stuff on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
The seconds, the managers, the valets, the heaters, all had a part to play. Whether they were swiping people out the ring when they're about to make a pin, whether they were on the ropes trying to distract the referee. It was so excessive.
You're getting bored at home if you're watching it. I've lived it. You are. Like, you're getting bored. It's enough.
And the thing is, it's like, just if you do predominantly clean singles and tags, this stuff will start to mean more.
Mm-hmm.
And it just felt like, my God, they're trying to get everyone on this card. My God, these matches are kind of structurally very similar in who gets the heat and how the catharsis is done. And still, I don't think it was a stunt show, because Christian Cage was doing his usual very good act, like excellent act, where he's wrestling like a dirtbag rat.
Barely does moves. He avoids them.
That's his new thing. He barely does moves. Which informs that it should, in theory, have that sort of that peak, that waveform, where we thought that the senton off the table was going to go off the top turnbuckle through to Christian Cage. For the last second, he rolled away and did the arm wave, and everyone went, But then, for whatever reason, that reaction didn't persist through the match, even though I thought the story told was good.
What was the other big dodge? Wardlow was going to do the Powerbomb Symphony on a bridge ladder, wasn't he?
Yes. And
Christian just low-blowed him at the last second. It was like, that's what he's going to do. They're going to keep showing you the idea, a preposterous spot, until it escalates into something the size of the Swanton. But it didn't really... didn't materialise like that, did it? Just stuff.
Which is stuff.
Quite entertaining stuff happened.
Yeah.
In bits and bobs. It was really hard in the arena to discern what was going on with Luchasaurus' thumbs and Arn Anderson's blood capsule, bladed thing. Like, God knows. God knows. There was a bit of blood. It was in weird places. I like Arn Anderson and Wardlow's... I've referred to it as, like, Steptoe and Son chemistry on Twitter.
Yeah.
It's really shabby, and it's sweaty and bloody, and it might stink of piss, but I think they're better together. They're messy bitches, them two. They are messy bitches, but I think that works.
Before the senton, they were really getting into Christian Cage winning this match, the crowd, though.
Yeah.
They really were, so that's another thing where, like, I thought it was a good idea. The execution wasn't as great as I thought it could have been. The heat wasn't there, but it's not working. Like, people wanted Cage to win, and Wardlow had to jump off what genuinely JR Hyperbole felt like a 20-foot-tall ladder.
Again, we're going off our live experience and things now ahead. You know, no other opportunity. We've literally just got back from the building. Wardlow, was it a gimmick ladder? And was that the intended idea to be like, wow, Wardlow is so big, he has bent metal and steel with his body when he jumped from the post to the ladder?
I think he just was.
Well, he warped it and then he climbed it anyway. And that was nearly a disaster. The ladder was dead and you could hear people in the building. Use another one, Wardlow. There's 50 there, mate. He climbed it anyway. And like,
it's not good when one of your top baby faces is dumber than everyone in the audience.
Yeah, like,
and I'm not saying he's dumb, I'm saying that in the heat of the moment, in a ladder match specifically, and in the modern era, you do the matches laid out to you.
Mm.
I would like a bit more improvisation.
He did that really sexy shoulder block where he dodged a falling one, and we were like really impressed that he just dropped a shoulder and was still able to like hit like the shoulder block.
It's like
the
ladder's meant to be this dangerous thing that you can't control. But the finish basically is Wardlow wins. Christian Cage took some punishment here. Like, he took a airplane spin onto a ladder ribs first. Like, it was genuinely quite wince inducing and gruesome and like gnarly. But again, before, like, in between the stunts, like, the fans lit, it was just like a raw taping volume. It was very strange. And again, Wardlow had to jump off a 20-foot ladder with a picture-perfect senton to get the fans back on board. You can't do that every week, so I do I do get the impression that they're going to have to do something else with him.
Yeah, it was the most... that when he stood atop that ladder and he had his balance and he had his arms out wide, it kind of felt the hottest he'd been since he was like conducting those early powerbombs. But you realise it was heat for the drama of the stunt more than for the man, the match, any of that sort of stuff. So it's hard at the moment. It's hard to discern what they can do to change these from like being like empty calorie pops to meaningful moments again.
Yeah.
Like, I would even extend that to like the semi main on this card, as good as some of that was. So it's just, I think it's a bit of a booking problem. It's always like we talk about booking because it's the most important thing.
Yeah.
It is, and you see it reflected here.
Was it Storm and Hayton next?
Yes. Weird.
This is weird.
Weird, weird, weird.
You would never have this with a men's world title match on a pay-per-view.
No.
Ever. Ever. Because they sell these shows because the men are booked more favourably. And if there was a singles match and you learned that in the weeks ahead of it, your champion had been injured, and they could probably, and this is probably a bit, you know, of a topic worth delving into, how injured was she? And if she was that injured, should she have done as much as she did? She was like lifting Storm up for power moves at one point. If the shoulder's that bad, you can exacerbate it. That's a point definitely worth raising. But yeah, what happens is Storm comes out as a challenger. Hater's music hits. No one comes out. You sense something amiss because you knew something was just not right in the build and the various reports and the lack of build and the fact that she was legit injured or like really banged up at least from various reports. Then she eventually tries to make it out, but the Outcasts have attacked her. They drag her to the ring. You get sort of a... If you've not seen it, which you probably have, but it was basically a Money in the Bank cash-in match.
Kind of. One of two on the show.
Yeah. Where the person who is going to lose gets a little bit where you think, oh, maybe he isn't going to lose. But no, they do lose. And Hater gets pinned after a Sweet Cheeks music.
There was Ruby there. So, let me get the order right. Did Saraya came out, Britt chased her away. Ruby Soho continued to interfere.
Sprayed
her in the eyes, loosened the turnbuckle, and yeah, you said Sheeta came out, monster pop for her. She got rid of Soho, so like, oh, maybe Hater's got a chance, but Tony Storm propelled her into the exposed buckle,
yeah,
and then drilled her with the pulling powder of the Storm. I was it one of
Storm Zero, Storm I think.
So yeah, it was like the idea was, despite injuries, despite beatdowns, it's still taking all of this crazy interference. Outcasts are there. Heels, like the cheap heel title win. The work is great because these two are super physical with each other. But I think Hayes hurt. I got the feeling she was working, doing more than she should have been, working through her.
Yeah.
To try and have them have the cake and eat it. We're giving you that, as we promised. But you're not.
Yeah.
Like, all this felt a bit off.
All a bit off. Not on. That's why it was off.
But Tony Storm, I think, we're based on evidence. Like, she was great as champion last year.
Oh, yeah.
If you're going to have a weekly title defence from her, even if it's cheap heat stuff, it's going to improve the Outcasts as a stable and the Outcasts homegrown stuff. She's super credible.
Super credible, so there could be worse outcomes, but yeah, I just don't like how they went about this. And it just wouldn't happen with the men's world title in 1 million friggin' years, which incidentally was the length of the press scrum, which we attended. Really check good. Out That's YouTube really for clips of that. The Trios Open House Challenge was after this.
Yeah.
The House of Black come out. They are ungodly over. The Acclaimed come out with an exceptional rap from Max Caster. They are ungodly over. And I don't know if it's just the complexion of the crowd, their general feelings towards a lukewarm product, the lighting, the fact that Daddy Ass isn't anywhere near the expected advertised Trios standard, but they had a pretty boring match with an anticlimactic finish, very little of which really struck me. Like Brody King doing his
he splattered pancakes, Billy Gunn,
like pancakes, sent on spot when they're upright in the chair spot was great, but you see it in every single House of Black match. Anthony Bones mimicking Malachi Black's pose again, quite fun. This heat and this volume, I couldn't believe it because I had this pegged as one of the sleeper hits of the undercard. Because
tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
They were both so over on that Dynamite taping. And in fact, they were both so over. Like, the House of Black are one of the most over acts on this entire show, this entire company. I was expecting magic here. Didn't get it. The heat was boring. At various points, it felt like a Raw match.
Yeah.
Which was just a trios title match on an AEW pay-per-view between two of the most over acts in the company. You should be rubbing your hands with glee. You should be losing your mind with excitement. There was very little of that. I get the reasoning behind the finish, but basically, after what felt like an age, Billy Gunn did nothing at all, except wait for the hot tag that was continuously cut off. He gets in the ring, tells people to suck his gack, and then Malakai Black just hits him with what used to be the Black Mass and pins him. I think it's meant to be this jarring shock of, oh, it doesn't matter how over someone is, or how big they are, or how, you know, nominally legendary they are, the House of Black will kill you with one strike sometimes, and that's the end. This didn't do anything for me at all.
I think the finish reeked of politics. Billy Gunn has to get pinned, because why would you pin one of the acclaimed when Billy Gunn's out there? But he only agrees to get pinned off the Black Mass if he's allowed to monster Brody and Buddy first.
Yeah.
And he did. He did a proper no-sell of the entire... Not just Brody King's physical offense, the aura. Now, I'm big and jacked, so you. And then it was pretty cool, actually, but, he hit, an elevated... Buddy Matthews was, bridged slightly across the top rope, and he hit the Famouser through it and, spiked his head with it. So, and then he just turned into that Black Mass. Best bit of the match for me was House of Black's gear. The silver and white look. It's been a good week for me in the House of Black. I will say that I'd needed to have the live experience of them twice, as it turns out, to understand the appeal. I get it. I completely get it. I'm still a fan of the lights. I still think the crowd spade use is a good compromise, because I think the ring looks nice and light.
I hate it now.
See it on the scoreboard, on the screen. Didn't need to watch the screen tonight because our seats were so fantastic.
Yes.
But I did have a look at the lighting just to see what the match would look like on telly, and I get it. I get it enough, and it'll be a visual identifier of the rain, but I don't know. The visual identifier of the rain should be some really great title defences and some quality stories.
Yeah.
This disproved a take I had on Thursday, and I won't say it again, or I'll try not to, and people on Twitter can pick me up if I do. I believed for a while that you can just do matches with the House of Black because of the way they are. I think this is... told me I was wrong.
Potentially.
Maybe stories in trios matches with them still matter a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, the most fun element of this match was Max Caster had made a joke about Dominic Mysterio.
That got a reaction.
So Buddy got a lot of that in the ring, and it was just a bit of fun in the arena.
You know? It was like a TV taping / house show. Did not have the prestige, the exhilaration, the match quality, the work of the AEW trios division thus far, which is disappointing. Taya Valkyrie lost to Jade Cargill. Have I missed a match or not?
I don't think so. I know it. Yeah,
While I talk about this, can you quickly on there, the Pro Fight DB or the wiki page?
Please mention Jade Cargill's entrance first.
Oh my God, Jade. So Taya Valkyrie comes out. Jade Cargill comes out flanked by some dancers and then participates in the dance herself. It's an absolute superstar entrance, and it really gets the crowd worked into the fact that, well, this is a big match. And they really got into it.
Yeah.
Elements of this were genuinely fab. Absolutely fab. Taya Valkyrie doing the Taiji Ishimori sliding German suplex kick ass.
Great moment in the building. That
was absolutely, couldn't believe it. There were a few other moves not too dissimilar to that, where you're thinking, where have you pulled this from?
Yeah.
This is great. And then Layla Gray starts distracting Taya on the ropes, and I'm thinking, what are you doing? What are you doing? We've done this in every other match other than the trios title match. And after a really good near fall when Valkyrie finally hits the Jaded. It's one of those where it's like, do you waste what, 2 months of a story that doesn't really do anything on TV to get a 1 second pop on a pay-per-view? Maybe you do.
Yeah.
It could all be good, that would be better, but if nothing else, they got that near fall, like one of the closest on the entire night until we got to the final two matches. Anyway, doesn't work, Jade kicks out, promptly hits a Jaded of her own, wins, after which, actually tell us your thoughts on the match here. It was they did get badly lost at one point.
They did.
Audible groans lost.
Yeah, we judge these ones because ultimately bad creative, and it's a WWE thing as well often. When there's rubbish creative and only okay matchmaking when it comes to titles, one of our standards is that we say, can they get you on a near fall, on a title change? Can they get you to be all the way through 100% certain of the result and then somehow convert you to 99 and 1%? And I think they did better than that with the tie of Valkyrie. Is it Road to Valhalla, as she calls it? Like, the Road to Valhalla attempt on Jade was way more effective, way more like credible as a way that she could actually end this 59-0 unbeaten run than I think I gave it credit for in the story, that when it was all about not being allowed to use a finisher. Because the near fall was so impressive, for a split second, smart Mark Sterling's stupid legal wrangling was justified, because you could understand why, as a tactician, he was afraid that Jade was going to get hit with it. And I put that down to the work beforehand, how stiff they were. I genuinely sort of think without that German suplex, without Jade being under fire and looking a little bit like, well, beatable, quite honestly, before she was, minutes later, without her looking beatable in the run-up to it, I don't think you get the Road to Valhalla tease being as effective as it was.
Yeah.
So I was, like, genuinely quite impressed with it. And I don't know, I go back and forth. Does Ty Valkyrie, on balance, warrant a profiled spot again after this? I think she does.
And she, like, got a reaction.
The character's hot, it's over, and there was flashes here that have convinced me that I think there's, like, more for her to do.
Yeah.
I don't think she's just a Jade loser and, like, you know, and maybe ultimately in the women's division, because it is often so marginalised, unfortunately, maybe that's off you go to Ring of Honor for matches until we tell you otherwise. But I hope she's kept around.
Yeah.
Like, I think she's shown her value tremendously in this week. I've seen it.
Yeah. So after the match, Smart Mark Sterling grabs a microphone. Smart Mark Sterling took a quality bump from Taya Valkyrie after a top rope, just basically looked like a top rope version of a Tez press.
Yep.
She crushed Smart Mark Sterling underneath. He grabs a microphone in the post match, says that there's absolutely no one left, so consider this the end of the reign or whatever, or just, yeah, just a basic, there's absolutely no one left. And that summons Chris Statlander, who in a open challenge / impromptu match, which they'd at least established on Rampage as something that they've done, but again,
oh yeah, I should be kind of, and I've forgotten about that.
I still don't like it at all, to be perfectly honest, but they've tried to make it seem a little bit logical, like it's been planned out. And a returning Chris Statlander, I'm exhausted, returns to a massive pop, really heartfelt reaction. Lovely, like, really heartwarming to see her come back. And again, the little mini Money in the Bank cash in that she actually takes a near fall where you think she isn't going to win the title, but she wins it within a matter of minutes, setting up a rematch, probably finally putting an end to the Jade Cargill reign. It got a huge pop in the building.
Yeah,
I just wasn't a fan of the impromptu aspect. I need to very quickly WhatsApp fill something for work.
Okay.
So filibuster for 2 minutes on a 2 minute match.
Well, I've got nothing to filibuster about the match, but I had an opinion and I got a bit of grief on Twitter for it, so I'll talk about that instead. I think that this was absolutely awesome and potentially a milestone in terms of, like, historically bad creative. And I think it can be both of those things, and I think that's a bit sad. Like, I've seen cash-ins before live and they're very, very, very satisfying. There's the element of surprise. Title changes are cool. In this case, it's Jade Cargill, and the end of the streak is pretty cool too. So all of that is really good. Chris Statlander is a huge sentimental favourite. She's done incredible to come back from not one but two devastating injuries. She is a homegrown in much the same way that the current baby faces in the AEW women's division are. So it kind of stands up as this nice achievement for AEW originals to be given a belt. And yet, they've never done this before. They've never had an impromptu match that has resulted in a title change, that has resulted in a major star losing their title, losing their unbeaten run, whatever it is, whatever's the stakes at the time. In this case, for Jade, it was both. They've never done it before. They've never... WWE have normalised this to such a degree, and you pick this up, and it was the one that I remember trying to defend because he called it hours earlier on Twitter, but you picked this up specifically with Big E. The nicest man in the world has the nicest day at his job. It is impossible not to adore that. But WWE have normalised the fact that that should never be just okay.
Ever. No, it was just...
And AEW have just done it, and it makes me feel a bit weird and a bit sad because you only get... Basically, you only ever get to do this once for the first time. But the point is, you should never, ever do it. And that first should never be a first. You should never be, well, we've been around 4 years. It was high time we did this, like impromptu, almost cash-in adjacent title. Was it? I don't think it was.
No.
I don't think it was. I think everybody, because we're trained to watch AEW, I think everybody in this building thought, Chris Statlander's back. And she chases Jade off. And it's like, Chris Statlander's back. And that's the moment. And when anybody complained.
And then just do the match on TV.
Yeah.
So weird. There's set such a WWE babyface thing to do, and I wasn't a fan of it.
I don't think we'd be talking on these podcasts in the way we do about wrestling if we didn't flag it, genuinely. Like, because people will, I understand getting washed up in sentiment. I like watching wrestling through that lens, but like, it's not nice to watch, you know, the pillars, AEW four pillars of wrestlers, but there are pillars of booking decisions and mentalities and structure, and another one has fallen for me. This is like the rankings fell. The discipline around DQs and countouts is like wobbling. And one fell here. And I hate that. Legitimately, I hate it as much as I love it for Statlander, the person and the performer.
I have the exact same opinion. And it follows Darby Allin celebrating getting a bye.
Yes.
And
yes.
It's like, if we can't in AEW be white hot, pack out every arena, have the loudest fans... this company, and that I think it's one of their most impressive achievements, and how many great ones and how many different ones they have, particularly when WWE weren't able to do it for decades before Cody and Sammy came along, actually built so many different kinds of baby faces. It's a baby face factory. Mm. Cassidy, Moxley when he's a baby face, Hangman, you can get three more different ones.
Yeah,
they were all incredible and effective. And if you start losing perspective when you're booking on what it is to be a baby face, and that really worries me. That really, really worries me.
Tony Khan, and he was using the in the scrum, which you will soon be able to watch on whatculture.com's YouTube channel in two parts. Tony Khan, because it's Tony Khan, he has a lot to say. But he used the release of the game, the release of Collision, and the start of Collision and Forbidden Door as, and he kept kind of like beating this drum. June is going to be huge for AEW. June's really big. I believe June is going to be, it's going to be a great month. But he also was saying AEW was changing quite a lot, and it was in relation to those things, and it was relation to, I think, the changing face of the top of the card, maybe.
Yeah.
And like, which is fine. As it should change, things should evolve, but I don't necessarily think these are particularly good changes. And I wonder if he's waving away bad habits by just saying AEW is changing, guys.
Yeah,
it can still be fine. It's just going to make a few changes. You know, it can be a lot like King of the Hill or Seinfeld.
Yeah.
It's not just about good guys versus bad guys. So change it if you want to change it, but try to remember some of the fundamental tenets that brought you to the dance.
That's just the way you said it. The Four Pillars match was next. MJF successfully defended against Jack Perry, Sammy Guevara and Darby Allin. The minor complaint out of the way, because the way they did the finish was fantastic.
Yeah.
I thought that this reached a peak of exhilaration and drama and then tried a bit too hard in the last 4 minutes to get back to where that was.
Yeah.
And I thought this was absolutely sensational as a match. Loads of story, so much concentration required and so much focus and memory skill to make it seem like, oh, I have to, I'm in this position somehow, when you have to remember how to go there. Everyone with taste, anyway, buries, quite rightly, the turn-taking approach to the WWE triple threat match, where two people wrestle in the ring and one sells outside, and etc., etc. This was like the antithesis of that, where there were so many incredibly convoluted sequences that required awesome positioning, awesome cardio, awesome athleticism, awesome storytelling to weave everything together so one thing flowed from the next between all four men. It was genuinely a great achievement, I think, in that respect. It was also really funny. MGF's slapstick bumps were fantastic. The little verbal interplay between him and Sammy Guevara, who, as revealed during his entrance, is about to have a baby. Mm-hmm. So MGF, like an arsehole, trying to use that for leverage to get Sammy to pin, to lay down. There was just all sorts of incredible stuff. And what's funny is that, if I can reduce it to the sum of its parts, a lot of it was, a lot of the moves I've seen on AEW television for years and years and years that I'm no longer as wowed by as I used to be.
Yeah.
But it was so frantic and it was threaded together so well that I just popped for every Canadian Destroyer, every aerial. There's one bit I want to pull over in particular before I get your thoughts. They do this bit where MGF, as happened several times, has been ganged up on by the pillars.
Mm.
Which is an ideal, because at one point the 3:1 babyface ratio got boos in the building and MGF got cheers because three babyfaces were ganging up on a heel.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what wrestling audience it is, what promotion, there's always this, are you a babyface if you're doing that sentiment?
Mm-hmm.
That's why so many War Games matches booked by Triple H have had that. What's going on here then?
Yeah.
Ganging up on the heel, so I'm not going to react to that. Mm-hmm. These actually sequences got booed, but they soon got the crowd back with these incredible things that they did when MJF was on the outside selling. Like the bit where Bryce Remsburg in most MJF matches will go 1-2. 1-2, 1-2, when the holds and the pinning combinations are exchanged furiously. They somehow did a three-way version of this really deep into the match. The cardio required for this is unbelievable, by the way. You should never like lose perspective of that. But like two people getting pinned at the same time, or like there were two bodies moving so one wrestler could pin the other and then transition to a pin on the other.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, genuinely, my mind was boggled by how they did a lot of that. MJF gets the pin by putting the belt, draping the belt on Jack Perry's stomach when Darby Allin does the coffee drop. So Darby Allin just bumped on the triple B.
Mm-hmm.
That allows MJF to do the headlock takeover to get the win. This was furious. Like, there was a, Jack Perry did the spot where, you know, the James Bond crocodile. What Bond is that from?
I can never remember, but I love the visual.
Yeah, so the visual of Bond jumping over the crocodiles. Jungle Boy jumps over Guevara and Allen's back to give a Canadian Destroyer to MJF after, like, a bang, 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 destroyer, destroyer, destroyer. And I don't even think that was the best destroyer in the match, because MJF did a move to Jungle Boy that was reversed into one. This was insane, flowed together brilliantly. I think they might have missed the peak of it by about 4 minutes, but what a class match, I thought.
Yeah, I would rather they shot and aimed as high as they did and missed that peak, if that peak is so incredibly high, which is what this was. This was intricate. This was, at times, like almost too visually pleasing for its own good, considering that they were all fighting for the title. You know, they were so elegant in the delivery of some of these moves that it had you in that, God, this is really good, but not, God, he wants to win the title. And then there were lovely story beats towards the end where people did want to win the title, and this pinfall saves became the gripping moment. I was really impressed live that I didn't find myself looking for wrestlers leaning on the apron with their head. I forgot to put over Christian's little rising up to see if he could come out yet.
Yeah, it was great.
But like, often you see wrestlers doing that as a shoot when they're in triple sets and four ways, because it's like, can I get back in and do my bit yet?
Yeah.
Oh, watching none of that. Didn't see any of that in this one. So super impressed with that. MJF's comedy won the day for me. There was two spots in particular. When he did the strut into the hip swivel, it was just majestic.
Yeah.
But him, so the I'd suggested there might be like, he does a really great low blow, doesn't he, MJF?
Yes.
But like, they're all doing like the kind of battling back up to the feet. We're all going to swing for each other, and he just goes for like three eye pokes.
Yes. Like,
that was so tremendous.
I love that, because I kind of needed it, because yeah. that, when they were doing that elsewhere, did border on the cliche to me.
Uh-huh.
Like, that's what a wrestler does when they are doing that spot, is they want you to say, fight forever, this is awesome.
Mm.
Which I guess, you know, everything they do is to get a reaction in a big chant, but I just find it so transparent.
Well, he
contrived.
It's funny you say that, because he popped the balloon earlier with that, when the three of them did a fish out of water spot, and everybody, as is the case, wrestlers do a kip up at the end of it, and everybody goes clap, clap, clap. And he got on the apron and did the patronising clap himself. Great wrestling, boys.
Yes, yes, yes.
And I felt like that kind of character work, and then you've got the thing in the middle where he offers Sammy the dive. After all of his plans, you know, he offers him the dive. I thought the character work was on it, the backbone of the match, in the same way MJF's promos were the backbone of the story.
Yeah.
A really, really good bit of business that illustrated to me that the champion is the champion for a reason.
Yeah.
And they were nothing more than challengers. There's probably a Darby singles match in there. Darby's Elvis, the film's trash, you cannot do this. But the Darby Elvis gear was fantastic. Yes. The half and half. I wish he'd wrestled in it, quite honestly.
Yeah.
It looked that fantastic. Maybe there's a Darby element. Sammy Guevara's a babyface might yet take as well. Him being a dad, an upcoming dad, is going to help that too. But I saw something in him here.
His stuff in this match looked unbelievable.
And considering they fed you the Jungle Boy, Roddy Piper, I can't do it tease as the drama, might have been the wrong guy. Might have been, like, I know they've been doing that with Jungle, it's going to be Jungle Boy that cheats, and it doesn't. But maybe think about that, because there might be a babyface in Sammy more than there is.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Jungle Boy's going to turn. We don't know when that's going to happen, but that's going to leave a space for a babyface to drop into, and it might be Sammy Guevara.
Yeah. Potentially. I thought this was absolutely exceptional. Just shrieked at everything. One thing I will say is a pedantic flaw is that this was absolute destroyer city. You saw Shooting Star Press on the top rope to the turnbuckle. Spanish flies onto the two other guys in the four-way. Like, lots and lots and lots and lots of In Vogue 2019 action. Again, considering that this is meant to be a match between a established world champion main event and three opponents who are just approaching his level, it felt like the match that they would work, like a much better version of it with loads more texture and storytelling.
Yeah, the spots were thoughtful, but there were still spots.
Yeah, there was loads, like, this is more textured, thoughtful, pay-per-view worthy version of that. Let's go absolutely ballistic in PWG match, but it felt closer to one of the best PWG matches than a really worthy, come on, this is big time, fellas, main event headliner.
Yeah, and it wasn't the main event. It wasn't the top line match. Last year's world title match was, as we were reminded, Double or Nothing has a fun history of having lots of multi-mans go on last.
Apart from Punk and Hanger.
But it didn't last year.
Yeah.
Because, like, personal issues, well, they caused problems in this case, but they draw money too, and like, that's maybe what didn't happen here, and thus why the match had to go where it had to go.
Yeah.
And we watched what we watched next, and it couldn't have followed it.
Yeah.
Different matches.
Different matches.
Couldn't have followed it on the night, I don't think.
I was just, again, spellbound at times by the intricacy, the memory skills required to pull it off.
Yeah, it's a really good point about the memory, that, because
this is so complex.
There's so much.
This was so complex, but not like alienating.
No.
Like, it was just so complex. Like, I thought it was a real achievement, considering the expectations heading into it. The expectations were vast for Anarchy in the Arena, which was our main event. I thought it exceeded them, or met them at the very least. It was so awesome. So much fun to watch live. Like, so incredible. I had so many different nonsense coming out of my mouth watching this, all of which were an endorsement. So there's a live band this time who are playing Wild Thing. They loop it three times as just the brawls are spilling out. And I loved the idea of It wasn't quite, I wish I had six eyes, because if I don't look at that, I'm going to miss it because I'm watching this. But that was insane anyway. I like the idea of missing something in this match. And I got that at the start, but then it did sort of like converge in the ring. But then the near falls and that finishing stretch was so great that I can forgive it for not being anarchy, mostly by ringside, as opposed to in the arena. Yeah. But it was so, it was still anarchic, it was still ultra-violent, it was still so fabulously put together. There's like some of the kickouts for like those Psycho knees, one-winged angel saves, like it was some of the most devastating finisher, the most credible finishers in all of wrestling being furiously exchanged, and you believed every single one of them because these are masters of their craft who really protect their finishers and can have carry a credibility as characters. So anyway, they loop the live band loops Wild Thing. Turns out the singer is more BCC than the Elite, hence why they're doing Wild Thing. And after the third loop and more incredible action, the Young Bucks ward off, I think, Wheeler Utah up the stage. Then they decide, sick of hearing Wild Thing, it's not our song. Super kick the singer of the live band who had been revealed to be wearing a BCC t-shirt, and that's the moment when the music ends. So we get Double or Nothing 2019 callbacks with Mox and Kenny Omega, who sort of partner off. Yuta Danielson are with Hangman Page early in the match, and that leaves Matt Jackson and Claudio Castagnoli to do the this year's equivalent of the Eddie Kingston and Daniel Garcia bit, where they're the ones to go backstage. And oh my god, this is utterly fantastic. You just do, they do a split screen gimmick in the arena. I don't know if they did that on TV, because last year they just did cut to capture. Oh, you can't capture this, there's too much anarchy. So I don't know if the split screen was a bit of a betrayal of what the anarchy in the arena should be, or if it was just a necessary means of actually capturing it. Either way, that's the most pedantic of complaints. Cesaro does the swing to Matt Jackson in the concession stand and just puts his head in a bin.
Yeah.
And Claudio is a Terminator, but who can scream, and he's just so chuffed with himself and so high on his own violence that he just screamed at the top of his lungs. Their fight continues to spill out into the parking lot where they find a pickup truck and Claudio pile drive, I'm very tired, Jackson into it. So it's Jackson, Matt Jackson's turn to do the Eddie Kingston shamble down the ring to then do something really cool spot.
Yeah.
And that's something I can't believe that I got this right.
Yeah.
I am a victory lap guy. I've decided I am a victory lap guy. I had an idea that they'll do a secret explosion in this match, with the idea being that they can't advertise an explosions match. They can't even tease there being an explosion. With like that John Moxley, it's going to be more explosive than you think.
Yeah.
Because people would just get scared that it's going to suck after Revolution 2021. So this is so much better as a surprise. And my God, have you seen the photo of it?
No.
Oh my God, if you go on Twitter, there's a photo of it and it rules so hard. And it's a big explosion. It's Matt Jackson super kicking Yuta in the face.
Yuta was, I think, with it, yeah.
And then they subsequently take off Matt Jackson's shoe. You know what that means.
Oh, that means.
We're going to lose. And then before we get to that incredible salvo of Psycho save, One Winged Angel save, V-Trigger save, we get the moment where Kenny Omega, who's awesome in this match, is using his shield like a superhero, I have been reliably informed. It's great because he either does it as a shield and a weapon at the same time. He gets the edge and just smacks it off people's faces with a back elbow. He's awesome. Then you get the Hangman Page and Kenny Omega full reunion.
Oh my God.
And it was just so goddamn great when they stood up
2v4, wasn't it?
2v4 and thought, we were the best fucking tag team in this company.
Yeah.
One of the best in history. We can beat four men. It's Kenny Omega and Hangman Page. So just life-affirming stuff. Like, life-affirming stuff for a nerd like me. It was just absolutely incredible. But then the thumbtacks start making a difference, because now that Matt Jackson has lost his foot, which is law. It means he's going to a title. Usually it means a title change, but increasingly it means a loss, because he did it against Full Gear at FTR at Full Gear 2020. They get the thumbtacks out and they atomic drop him soul first into the thumbtacks. And they do a heel hook and like push in the pins, and it's gross. But it looks like the Elite are going to persevere, overcome. That summons Callis to the ring because he can't have that. He can't have Kenny win because that would prove his really awful decision wrong. So he can't keep winning.
Yeah.
You're my failing cash cow. You can't still have cash left in here, so I'm going to end you now for good. This summons Takeshita in a mask. And not the cleanest finish, but it's the finish.
Yeah.
And they Wheeler Yuta seatbelt Omega for the shock pin at 27 or so minutes, I believe it was. I absolutely adored this on an emotional level, on a fun level, spectacle, violence, just sheer exhilaration, deep storytelling. There's nothing I wanted more from this match, and I wanted the world for this match.
Yeah, it lived up to John Moxley's expectation-setting promo, and that's the biggest compliment I can pay it, because he promised the world. As a live, I don't know, in the days to follow, because I haven't looked online at what the reaction to this was, our awareness of this crowd being considered cold and quiet and whatever was because we were able to obviously check the timelines during the show. I didn't check the timeline during this match one bit, and then we were obviously straight into the scrum after the fact, so I don't know how Twitter took this match. I'm assuming very well, because even if the crowd did somehow still scan as quiet or some of the spots didn't work for you, there was that much. This was so dense in like what it included that I find it like, it's a bit like your thing about AEW in general being impossible to dislike if you're a wrestling fan, because they'll find something for you.
Yeah,
this match was kind of that as well. Like, I don't love hardcore wrestling or deathmatch wrestling or blood. Either way, I like it sometimes, and I like the context of it. But they showed me the versions here where you can bleed and it can be really, like, over the top and it'd be effective. Claudio dragging the bludgeoned referee out of the war zone via the camera, so you saw him covered in blood.
Rick Knox getting...
Rick Knox, yeah, that was it, yeah.
Rick Knox being the first to blade.
Yeah.
Like, chair shot to the head. How did they get another referee spot as good as the Karen Jarrett one? Was so funny.
Yet again, the biggest compliment, like, you've covered everything excellently there in the recap. Yet again, Anarchy in the Arena's biggest achievement, and I cannot wait for, I want round three. I've already pitched that, like, next year it should be an EDM DJ who just, like, somebody just pulls the iPod off to show that he wasn't doing any digging at all, and then he just runs a mile
in
abject piss pants fear from whoever is attacking him. It's, and you see it with WWE. Triple H loves a brawl. He bloody loves a brawl. But how many do you love watching of his brawls?
Not
that many. It is so hard to manufacture believable carnage.
Yeah.
It's really hard. You don't get it on Dynamite very often. Here come the run-ins. Here come the wall of punches, shared forearm, smashes to the face, whatever it is. It's so difficult, and they nailed it here. The Elite stuff, life-affirming was the exact word I had. There was the Page and Omega 2v4. There was the four-way Terminator dive.
Yeah.
But they all got on the knee for the setup, and it was just, yeah, like, again, like, I have a feeling people will be fairly quick to say this just wasn't up to the standards of last year's. I don't know, live, I wasn't in the building for last year's, I was in the building for this year's, and I'll remember it forever.
Yeah.
The bit, when the band were about to play the third one, they were coming to the end of the second one, and I saw the drummer stand up, and you know when Jarrett's playing the figure four and he does the, or Jake's DDT, the whirl with the finger, the drummer's like, one more? And the guy did one more, and it was like, the Cribs playing my favourite live song
I've
played 5 years. I was like, yes, I want to hear Wild Thing again from the top.
Yeah.
Keep it coming. Like, that's the magic of Anarchy in the Arena, and I applaud the wrestlers involved, like, just like I did last year, for the and the production for the ability to create this. Because as you say, even in a building, your eyes were darting around. You know when you're in a supermarket and you see a queue, you're in a queue, and you see another queue, you're like, I'm gonna go to that queue because I think it's gonna get smaller. and then you look to your left, and the queue that you were in is starting to move faster. So you try and move back, and it just keeps happening like that, and it's immensely frustrating. This is the joyous, celebratory version of that, because you're watching a thing. I was watching John Moxley hit Kenny Omega with a random guardrail he discovered, and you went, "Oh my god, a flip!" Right? And
Nick Jackson did some mad flip.
I missed that flip. So I looked
I'm grateful because it just meant the carnage was happening.
Yeah, I looked over to the flip, at which point the flips happened. There's not going to be like a second flip. Yeah. And then there was like a, oh! And Moxley had done something else. And I was like, I moved. That's on me.
Yeah.
They're fighting. And it's not for my spectacle. It's for the fight.
Yeah.
And what that draws you into is just, like, it's a really immersive fan experience. They're not doing this for you. They're doing it to kill each other.
Yeah.
You just happen to be in the audience for it. It's an incredibly effective bit of business, and I hope they find the pairings next year for this to work again. And if we're working on the assumption that Blood and Guts isn't going to be in the women's division and it's in fact going to be here, I mean, it's going to kick ass when the booty rocks up, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, all good.
They have found
Sorry. For years, you laboured, and it was absolutely right you did so, on how much kind of Kenny was a prick for Paige reaching out constantly in tag matches, and Kenny just been like, I'm going to do the Bushi stuff. And they did the You Can't Escape, and Paige got fully involved as the Ibushi.
Yeah.
And they hit it, and they did it together. And Kenny and Ibushi's crack was that they could never actually hit that one together.
And
like Hangman doing the running moonsault to get involved with it, it's like, I'll play. And they did the You Can't Escape together, and it's like, they have never been more whole.
I loved it so much.
Really great stuff, that.
I absolutely love this. I'm so glad I got the chance to watch it live. And again, not to keep hammering on, that's because of you and your listens and your support. And that's our last one of Las Vegas. I'm exhausted. I'm going to sleep for 5 hours and then do some writing because I just simply cannot do it now. But let us know what you thought about the show from the TV perspective, because we are very interested in that, underneath the Twitter link to this podcast at WhatCultureWWE on Twitter. Whilst you're there, you can follow Michael Hamflet at...
Michael Hamflet, I just want to echo those thoughts. I know you're desperate to go to that.
Yeah.
I want to echo those thoughts. It's our last one here in the hotel room. It's been an unbelievable week. AEW has been like something that we've desperately wanted to be in the room for. And obviously, because we're goddamn Brits, we haven't had the opportunity. So this has been just dream stuff. Thank you for being patient with the audio quality dip. We are aware of that. We hope the analysis quality hasn't dipped even... including the SmackDown review, which I do recommend you listen to. Specifically niche feedback for that one as well. It's just been a tremendous week. It's been a week of different podcasts, I think.
I know.
But no less flavourful.
Absolutely. So thank you very much for joining us. If you haven't already subscribed to What Culture Wrestling, wherever you get your podcasts from, and we will see you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favourite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.